right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, all of you good, wonderful citizens of Crypt Nation, welcome back. We have another fantastic episode and guest here for you today. I am joined by just an incredible person here in the crypto space, somebody who I've been following their podcast, following them on Twitter, following their company. This is what I would call a Bitcoin OG, a local legend in the crypto space, but this is Alex Thorne. He's actually the head of firm-wide research at a very well-known digital assets company called Galaxy. So Alex, thanks for joining us today, and how are you doing?
Yeah, Bryce, thanks for having me. I'm doing great. It's exciting times in the market. You know, we weathered 846 days since the last all-time high in November 2021. And wow. Some people didn't think we would be back, but here we are, still standing and frankly, basically right where we were at the last all-time high. And I'm pretty confident we have more room to run. So it's going to be an exciting time.
Have you ever wanted to trade Bitcoin but haven't dared tried? With Plus 500 Futures, you can trade crypto without the hassle of opening a wallet. With just a few clicks, you can register and start practicing with their free and unlimited demo. See a trading opportunity? You'll be able to trade in just two clicks. Feel ready? You can move to real money with as little as $100 once your account is approved. And the great thing is that in addition to crypto, Plus 500 gives you access to a wide range of instruments like the S&P 500, NASDAQ, gas, and much more. Explore equity indices like energy, metals, Forex, and beyond. With a simple and intuitive platform, you can trade anytime, anywhere. Experience the fast, accessible futures trading you've been waiting for with Plus 500. With over 20 years of experience, Plus 500 is your gateway to the markets. Visit us.plus500.com to learn more. Trading in futures involves risk of loss and is not suitable for everyone. Not all applicants will qualify, and this is not personal financial advice. Plus 500, it's trading with a plus.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. Just jumping right in. I mean, if you think about where we were at 800 and something days ago, you know, 3 years ago, right? The market was so much less mature. The market was so much less liquid. By every metric, the market was worse off. Yet the prices today are still the same. So it's such a funny, like, you get so much more bang for your buck by buying Bitcoin at today's all-time high than if you were buying at, you know, 3 years ago all-time high. But I just want to, you know, pick your brain. I mean, even before we jump into your background, before we, you know, dive into all that stuff, like, what has changed that makes Bitcoin such a better asset now, even though it's priced the same as it was 3 years ago?
Yes, I should point out that in if we adjust for inflation, we're actually not there at the all-time high yet. That's somewhere in the high 70s, I think, because we've obviously had, you know, relatively significant inflation in the U.S., also around the world, specifically since late 2021, which is when the Fed first started signaling that they were going to start raising rates. So, but yes, it is, you know, a lot has changed. I think I haven't heard somebody say this yet, more bang for your buck. It is true. You know, you have to, the market and the market infrastructure in crypto assets has gone through a trial by fire, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, at the last top, you know, FTX was the major offshore crypto margin futures exchange. The lending businesses were all flying high at billions of dollars that they'd brought in. All of that is unwound, obviously. And I think in many cases, for good reason. I mean, the decline in crypto asset prices following the November 2021 all-time high really exposed some very, we'll say it, a euphemism, some shaky business models, right? Or perhaps unsustainable business models. And in worst cases, obviously, in the case of FTX, we now know officially criminal fraud or criminal whatever it was that he technically was convicted of. Yeah. So look, we've come through that trial. I think we've certainly become stronger. I think you've seen some consolidation in the market in terms of where things trade, where things are custodied, what types of lending businesses, for example, are deemed sort of acceptable levels of risk versus what was done in the past. Crypto exchanges have consolidated and updated. We've seen some really interesting developments on the transparency side. You actually have law in Texas that is proof of reserve. We've seen the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, bipartisan members of the Senate Banking Committee, introduce a law called the PROOF Act, a bill which would mandate proof of reserves on crypto asset exchanges and custodians. We're not all the way there yet, but that's a big shift from people saying, oh, let's just put all our assets on FTX. And there were people back then, I'm not saying I was one, but it was when you talk to data providers that do like exchange attribution, right? And they try to track like how many coins are held by an exchange. It was pretty well known, an open question among the data providers, like where is FTX's cold storage, right? In fact, like there's this. So anyway, some of that is also improving. And of course, I would say the maturity of the parties that are now involved in the particularly in the American crypto asset market is significantly higher, right? I mean, now some of the big names that you're going to hear, for example, talking about the upcoming halving, it's going to be firms like Invesco and Fidelity and BlackRock, in addition to the crypto natives like Bitwise and Galaxy and whoever else. But like we have significantly de-risked Bitcoin in particular as an asset, and that's created a lot of enthusiasm, I think, this time.
Yeah. Oh my God. There is so much to unpack there. And before we get too ahead of ourselves, I want to introduce you to the audience. I mean, they're probably, listeners of your podcast as well, Galaxy Brains. And so I'm sure a lot of people are really excited to hear from you over on this side of the house. But we would love to just get to know you. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you found yourself as head of firm-wide research at an incredibly large crypto company.
It's been a pretty wild ride. I started my career at Fidelity Investments. I was ultimately there for almost 12 years, right?
Oh, so wow.
This is actually the second company that I've worked for since I graduated from college. I started in the legal group at Fidelity right out of college. I was effectively really an analyst in the legal department. You might say paralegal, except that's actually a job that you need training for, litigation paralegal, very actually difficult job. I was more just like a gopher in the legal group, right? Someone needs to get those documents like sorted or organized. Like that's what I started as. I eventually oversaw what's called litigation support function, which is effectively forensic investigation for litigation matters. So managing all the evidence, gathering, managing evidence, managing the various parties in interactions with the evidence. So effectively a computer investigative role. I studied poli-sci though, but I also as a young child, I was interested in building and destroying computers and interested in things like file sharing and distributed networking. And so I had this interest, and I was doing this job, and it was right, you know, I'd gotten interested in Bitcoin when I was interested in working with encryption tools as part of that job, and was very interested in encryption, and had seen some people online had pointed out that there were people during the Euromaidan protests in Ukraine. The last time that Ukraine was an important geopolitical
2014 or something like that.
Yeah, right? 13-14. And that they were asking for donations in Bitcoin. And I was like, what is Bitcoin? That sounds interesting. And so I thought it was quite interesting purely as sort of digital money, not so much as I didn't go down the rabbit hole on, you know, scarcity or store of value or even monetary policy, but I was primed. I did work for, I volunteered for Ron Paul's presidential campaign in 2008. I've been involved in sort of like libertarian, you know, critiques of monetary policy. So, but I didn't really think twice about it. I thought it was cool. But then in 2015, Abby Johnson, the CEO of Fidelity Investments, CEO and chairman of Fidelity, she got personally interested in Bitcoin and directed some folks to start looking at it. And eventually those people reached out around the company being like, who knows about Bitcoin that we can talk to? We're doing like an information gathering exercise, right? Mm-hmm. And I was discovered as someone who knew a lot about it, partly because my job involved working on the cases that defend or involve Fidelity business units around the entire firm, centralized legal group. And so I had talked to people all over the company and inevitably over the years, talked their head off about Bitcoin. So people were like, you got to talk to Alex. One thing led to another. I did I was a senior compliance advisor for Fidelity Institutional, but eventually I was hired as director of blockchain research at Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, which is sort of the company's centralized tech innovation hub. So they worked on things like AI and machine learning and big data and blockchain and whatever else, right? Did that for a little bit in 17 and some of 18. And then Fidelity leadership decided to launch a crypto-focused venture fund called we named it Avon Ventures that they hired my old partner Sachin to run, and he hired me to work with them. And I did crypto VC basically out of Fidelity for 2.5 years, and then I came to Galaxy to lead research. So that is the full story, but it's been a long road.
That is what I call from the mailroom to the top of the food chain kind of story. That is awesome.
I was hired like basically at the lowest possible level. And by the way, I graduated in 2009, so I was very happy to even have a job. This is a terrible time to try to get a job. Like September 2009 was basically the height of the great financial crisis recession. I mean, I was hired at like basically the lowest level possible at Fidelity and spent 12 years there. So yeah, I started as effectively a junior analyst, not like literally below paralegal in the legal group and left.
I've seen suits.
Yeah. And I left as one of the two people investing Abby Johnson's money in crypto startups.
Wow. It just goes to show, I mean, you know, no matter where you are starting your career, just show up, be passionate, be consistent, be hardworking, and, you know, have strong convictions and you'll end up, maybe if you're lucky, you'll end up like Alex.
I would say I totally agree. Most of the reason that this worked was two things. One, I was passionate on an extracurricular basis while doing my normal job and trying to do it very well. I became very interested in Bitcoin and at least tried to become an expert in it. And of course, I got lucky that I was at a company that also was ended up being very interested in it, basically first of its peers to be interested. But I also tell people, especially if you work at a big company or big corporation, learn about the dangerous thing. Become the expert in what kills your company's business, because eventually they will come trying to figure out how to either incorporate or avoid it. And I think Bitcoin, it doesn't brick Fidelity at all, but like something that's disruptive to the global financial system, well, that's of serious interest to smart leaders of financial services companies.
Totally. And clearly you see, I mean, you were way ahead of the times and Fidelity was really way ahead of the times, but now they're taking in billions of dollars a month. I think, you know, something around $6 or $7 billion into their ETF now. BlackRock's got another 10 or so billion. I mean, and it's just really showing no signs of slowing down. Like you mentioned, there's just, you know, an incredible amount of inflows from really a new universe of market participants, people that were not in the market just flat out at the scale that they are now, you know, even just 1 year ago. So it's just so cool to kind of see everything evolving. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy that, you know, we made it through several bear markets and bull market cycles and never lost our head, just always stayed cool. And, you know, I think part of the reason is, you know, just getting to speak with folks like you, who really helped me define my conviction. And I'm curious, for somebody like you, you know, what is it that helps you define your conviction in the crypto space? Is it just speaking with other smart people and kind of comparing notes and seeing like, yeah, like, you know, this guy's got great metrics and et cetera, or is there some other, you know, deeper thing that keeps you grounded?
I mean, there are a lot of smart people interested that have different perspectives and may gather different data or be interested in different use cases. And it absolutely helps to talk to people. A big part of my job is talking and learning from other people, including my team. I have a team of 6 people at Galaxy that do research with me that I learn from, right? Like somebody's like, how can you talk about Bitcoin and RWAs with such authority? And I'm like, well, I literally read my edit and read my team's research on it. They're the ones who are on that. They're teaching me so that I can help teach you. That's true. Networking and discussions, very important. I would also say that I have a deep passion in human liberty. I also believe disruption as something that is both inevitable and important. I was telling some folks yesterday that the status quo will always perpetuate the lie that the system is as it's meant to be, right? Mm. That systems are secure, that institutions are permanent, that we've solved that problem. That is the deep-seated interest of the status quo, right? That's why innovation is, by definition, disruptive. These types of revolutions that I think this is one of, public blockchains, Bitcoin, DeFi, et cetera, these types of revolutions are inherently disruptive. And we tend to get myopic about history and think that revolutions only happen in textbooks, right? That we may not live now, at least Americans, I would say, because it's been relatively stable. Plenty of people around the world have lived through revolutions even in my lifetime. But
oh yeah,
I think it's very easy to become myopic and forget just how long human history is and how old the world is. And it's really not crazy to think that everything could change. And I so and in Bitcoin and public blockchains, I see the type of disruptive technology that could and should create a similar revolution. And that is something that I want to work on.
Yeah, no, I love it. And what's so cool about, you know, Bitcoin, I mean, it could take the form. It's like such a good outlet for so many different reasons to be bullish on it. For instance, you said, like, from a libertarian standpoint, like having free permissionless money, that's a public good. Like, that's super attractive. From like a Fidelity or BlackRock standpoint, like, you know, adding it to the, you know, diversified income model portfolio or whatever, you know, as just a random person who lives in a different country who's experienced inflation, you know, at just exorbitant rates, like, it's a good reason for them. So what I'm so bullish on it because it fills so many needs. And then not even to mention crypto as a whole, right? You got, you know, Ethereum, Solana, et cetera, which are just great ways to scale, you know, decentralized applications and all that stuff. So, you know, to me, I mean, this is, you know, blockchain networks are absolutely going to house money of the future, applications of the future, identities of the future. It's like, how could anybody be bearish on this? Like
it's going to be a rocky road. I mean, there's so many. Think about this. When I was at Fidelity, we did a lot of proof of concept on the concept of blockchain. So not crypto, not Bitcoin. I mean, plenty of stuff on that too, but many attempts at doing what I used to call enterprise blockchain. You know, like, right. Wait a sec, what if we could use the blockchain for something else? Can we replace some existing business service or back-end process with a blockchain? And we found over and over again that it really wasn't going to work. And the reasons were usually significant institutional barriers to adoption, as in some cases, entrenched interests who actually profit from the existing system and would be disintermediated, right? Literally a simple one. Many cases, blockchain, not the right technology. The problem wasn't, you know, not having multiple parties able to reach consensus on a data set. It was something else, right? And I'm still today of the view that the blockchain is primarily useful for getting either unknown or even adversarial parties to agree on the state of a ledger. That's why it's such a good use. Money is such a good use case, because when you walk into the bodega to buy, you know, a drink or something, and you hand the person a dollar bill, they know, holding it, they can feel it in their hand, and they know by sight and touch that transaction is settled. They don't, that now they're holding the dollar, like, we're done, right? They don't, there's no risk that you could roll it back. They don't, it's actually quite easy for people to tell forgery, so they know it's authentic, right? And that's instant settlement, that trustworthy. Again, you could be a thief, not of that store today, but of a different time, right? You could be adversarial to him. Doesn't matter. If the goods are exchanged and the cash is in hand, transaction is finalized. Like, the blockchain is the only thing that can allow that to work without intermediaries in the digital world. And this is going to be, it already is, but it's going to be an extremely more digital world. I know it seems like we're already on our phones today, but just wait in 10, 20, 50 years. I think, frankly, it'll be unrecognizable to today. I think we're going to look back at 2024 in 2050, 2075. We'll look back at 2024 the way today we look back in the mid 1980s. Truly.
Yeah.
An iPhone's going to look like a rotary phone. I don't know what that means. I don't know what we'll be comparing it to. I don't know if we'll have a little like contact lens that is our, you know, AR life, but I just mean, like, we need permissionless open digital money. And just to the other point, I think there's many other use cases for it, but I'm also, maybe because of my upbringing in the Bitcoin and blockchain world, I'm skeptical of blockchain for everything, but I do see a lot of really interesting emerging use cases. And look, you can also get hindrance. Like, one of the ways I try to check myself here is I can have these purist views about what is and isn't an appropriate use of a public blockchain, but that also doesn't matter if people are using it for XYZ thing that I don't think is appropriate. And so we spend a lot of time on our team not documenting the theory of what blockchains are good for. I'm not running it at the moment, a technology incubator that's trying to make up new use cases for blockchain. One of the main things we do is track adoption and growth in the usage of public blockchains. So there might be some times when I say, look, this app, this chain, this layer, this use case is getting all of this usage. And gosh, that really seems silly to me, but that's not really, and I might even say that, but we're really looking for the usage itself, right? And we will evangelize when we see people using blockchains for different reasons. Everyone's always wondering that. It's a common question. Let's say you see somebody be like, yo, I saw a transaction spiked on XYZ network. Like, what's going on? That is a very common question. And I view it as a core part of my job to being able to answer that question.
Yeah. And we're going to dive into that in just a sec. I want to just spin back real quick to what you were saying about blockchains as just being the you know, perfect sort of medium for, you know, having adversarial, you know, counterparts being able to trust each other. Because what we're seeing right now, with, you know, with, for instance, you know, America freezing Russia's assets that were denominated in the US dollar and then giving it potentially to, you know, their enemy. It's like, well, they're never going to, you know, trust the US dollar again. And it doesn't matter about just Russia. It's every other country that might not be best friends with America that says, oh my God, they could do that to our assets too. It could happen to us too. And then American citizens saying it could happen to us too, because look at what happened in Canada when, you know, Canadian truckers had their bank accounts frozen, and which also got rescinded, you know, a couple years later as unconstitutional, and they had to backtrack and all that kind of stuff. But it really, you know, that can't happen with Bitcoin. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important. And you could just see as the BRICS sort of nations start to really get more, you know, steam, and the producer nations start to, you know, have their own sort of settlement layers, you know, the dollar is going to, you know, be cut out of it, you know, probably for the worse of Americans and for the betterment of others. But, you know, if we could all come to a level playing ground and settle on Bitcoin, I mean, you know, and be leaders there, you know, it doesn't have to be to the detriment of America. And hopefully, you know, institutions are waking up to that, and eventually governments coming around to that. But
yeah, it's a tricky topic, I would say, for Americans to grapple with. And totally. And I'm not sure exactly what the right answer is, but I do think that it is a core feature of Bitcoin, obviously, that you can transact trustlessly and without censorship with any party, right? And we can always track and say, hey, we don't like that transaction. So if we see any coins that derive from it later, we're going to be mad at them. We're going to seize them. We're going to put addresses on our sanctions list, XYZ. That is still possible. But to me, the freedom to transact, I think, is effectively a core human right. It's one of these inalienable rights that basically just de facto exists. If two, you know, ancient humans, like a caveman or something, meet on the path, like there's nothing that they need other than each other. If one says, I'll trade you that stick for this rock, like that's an inherent thing. Or more modern, think about a yard sale, right? Like, and now, sure, right? I mean, you start to see this leaking out, like, you know, tax agencies putting reporting on the fintech apps because they know they're missing out on some of the revenue. Technically, a yard sale transaction is taxable, right? But again, this is one of these areas where it's like, you really can't stop someone from walking down the street and buying something from their neighbor.
Like freedom of speech.
Yeah. To me, this is a core human value that Bitcoin finally helps instantiate in the digital world. When we became digital, we did not transpose this human right directly into the digital world. Instead, we effectively gave it up in favor of the slick UX that intermediaries provide. So I look, it's a tricky question how it relates to American power. I'm obviously a proponent of, as an American, of America being a strong and prosperous and of course, free nation.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, I agree. Look, it's a trickier time. You can see this in the appetite for holding treasuries abroad. Like, you can see, and it's not just the encumbrances that the U.S. government has put on the usage of the dollar, although that is a part of it. It's also the state of our debt and our fiscal situation, which, you know, I mean, think about it. The one thing that people come back to me when I say, hey, the dollar's not backed by anything either. Bitcoin's not backed by anything. I'm like, well, the dollar's not either. And they go, no, the dollar's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. Well, most intelligent observers believe that credit is degrading.
Even so, the S&P I saw like degraded some level of it.
Yeah, I mean, there have been some even downgrades in general. Don't get me wrong, like most fiat currencies are also pretty bad and getting worse. So like in some ways the dollar's absolutely still like the best.
Like the least smelly public bathroom if all the fiat currencies are smellier public bathrooms, but it's still kind of smelly. Like nobody wants to be in there.
There's a real risk and you know, that we don't get our fiscal house in order, and eventually you can't. The full faith and credit doesn't mean what it used to. And obviously we know with inflation and the purchasing power of the dollar, frankly, it degrades to infinity basically over time. Yeah. But yes, I think that's also a major factor. Geopolitics will continue to play a role in Bitcoin. I mean, you have nation states that have adopted it. You have nation states that are mining it, right? It is part of the global energy conversation. So I mean, it's an important thing to think about. It is tricky though.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to dive into what you were talking about where the growth is in the crypto ecosystem. You spent a lot of time looking at different metrics, kind of from an unbiased sort of observational viewpoint, and, you know, not asking for, you know, what's the hot token, what's the best coin, but what ecosystems do you see as growing? And not to throw anybody else under the bus, but which ones are shrinking that maybe people thought were growing?
Yeah, I think this has been quite an interesting rally. It's obviously Bitcoin led. And of course, that enthusiasm. First, look, we start off a small base at the start of last year, right? I mean, Bitcoin starts the year at 16,500, basically, in January 1st, 2023. That's a low base. People started buying. It was actually pretty short lived. By like January, we were back in like the 20s. And then the banking crisis happened in March, and you saw some uplift to Bitcoin, some accrual. I think there genuinely was a narrative for some buyers then saying, wait a second, like Bitcoin, it actually doesn't need to be backed by anything, right? It's totally transparent. We don't have these, like, you know, this underwater, you know, debt on its balance sheet, like banking system. I think I mentioned this because this can continue and will continue, I believe, basically forever to be one of the interesting narratives around Bitcoin, which is as an alternative to the banking system, not just the central banking system, which is the money printing part, which is also, I think, an interesting contrast. But then, of course, in June, you have BlackRock file for their Bitcoin ETF. And we all know the story. Over the last summer, in August, the DC Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of Grayscale against the SEC. And most observers at that time, and of course, we basically turned out to be right, said, including me, that this order really does appear to effectively order the SEC to approve it, because it explicitly and specifically strikes down their arguments, their historical arguments for rejecting it. So unless they think, you know, after 10 years, they can pull a rabbit out of a hat with some new argument for rejecting it, which, by the way, would be arbitrary and capricious in my view, because you can't just like come in at the 11th hour with some new reason. Then the Grayscale would have sued again. The court probably would have agreed that that was arbitrary. You can't like say these two things for 6 years and then invent a third at the 11th hour. So anyway, of course, they got approved. Anticipation led a rally in the fall. And you did what was interesting. One of the things that was interesting, we all know there's this historical intra crypto rotation trade that often happens. It happens at macro scales. It happens in microcosms. I mean, in one of the most iconic sort of big pictures that it happened was in December 2017. Bitcoin hits all-time high, I think December 17th, 2017. Ether then comes off a bit. Ether hits all-time high in January 2018. And then you had like an alt season in February and March, basically. And then basically everything, you know, went down into the bear market. We saw that in 2021. Remember, everyone was talking about the all L1 trade. Like, well, this L1 hadn't run yet. So like, you know, I've heard Dan Matuszewski from CMS Holdings call this the hot ball of money, right? So this rotational thing, and of course it can happen in sort of small things. So in the fall of 23, we saw September was pretty quiet. October, Bitcoin saw a big uplift. Then November, it kind of chilled, and you saw like basically alt season happen, but it wasn't ETH. Ether didn't really run. It was like meme coins primarily. Yeah. You had I'm not going to name them, but the dog themed tokens. And there was a little bit of a rotation where people, you would see one on one chain pop, and then a week later, like the one on the other chain would pop. This is that hot ball of money rotation trade. Of course, eventually Ether has rebounded, but it's still like, you know, 30% below its all time high. So that has been happening. I would say that there is enthusiasm, and it is going to keep happening. I've argued that the Bitcoin ETFs will dampen this feature of the price action, partly because if an increasing amount of Bitcoin is held in ETFs, particularly those inside advisor-managed accounts, those don't really day trade, maybe periodic rebalancing. Well, that's Bitcoin now that's not held on like a crypto exchange. It's not easily available to rotate into the next coin, right? So it becomes a little stickier. Now, I don't think that means it goes away, but I think that's an interesting thing to watch as a dynamic. Now, that being said, you're still seeing it nowadays. And so you're seeing some of that general rotation. You're seeing all L1s. You're seeing some other, you know, obviously it continues to be like a big meme coin rally. I saw your last episode was about meme coins, right? So there's plenty of that. But I think one of the things that's interesting is that outside, it's almost like a barbell right now happening. And there's a couple others, but you really do have Bitcoin still leading the way. And then you have a lot of meme coins, and there's some other platform, you know, L1s that are doing well too. And certainly Ether is doing fine. It's chugging along, but It's still relatively low. I mean, ETH BTC is a ratio I write about and talk about a lot. I mean, I haven't done it in a while because it's not that relevant, really. And
it hasn't budged.
And I don't think of that many. Well, it went up a little bit and then it came back down a little bit. And it's really sort of just flat, like basically in that same 0.055 range where it's been. But some big narratives that I like. So you have this sort of barbell with sort of Bitcoin leading the way on one side and like meme coins really on the other. I mean, on Bloomberg, there was a clip I saw, they said it's the season of meme coins or something, right? So it's actually seeping out, but you don't see some of the big sectors from the past running. DeFi, not really running hard, even though the applications themselves are frankly widely used and an important part of the crypto economy, but it's not like people are like, oh yeah, this great new lending protocol. You know, there's some airdrop related farming and stuff happening, but it's all sort of this like more memey, faster crypto native kind of behavior, right? Like you're not going to convince, like, I don't think most crypto native investors or users at this point, if you've been in it for a while, you're not like getting super jazzed up about the new lending platform, right? Like what explains so much enthusiasm around the meme coins is it's kind of just like, in the end, it's like the end boss of the crypto native stuff. It's like, you know, and we haven't really brought in whole new waves of new people yet. I really do believe that this rally is mostly driven by Bitcoiners and people that like Bitcoin on the ETF thing. And then the crypto natives who made it through the bear market, right? It's not like dozens of your other friends who used to be skeptical are now pulling up the phone. I haven't seen it at least. And so I think that's where it's like, you know, what are they going to get excited about? Like maybe the majors and the fund things or something like that. Other areas though that I like that I wanted to mention, obviously L2s, very important, huge usage of the Ethereum L2s. Dankun upgrade happens March 13th, which has Proto Dank sharding EIP 4844 in it, which is very additive to the ETH L2 story. It makes it cheaper for rollups there to pay for gas and settle. That should be further powerful. The transaction volumes you're seeing on the Ethereum L2s, I think in aggregate, well outpace the L1 transaction volume now. So it's a huge part of the Ethereum world. And then I should mention also now more increasingly part of the Bitcoin world. We've always had the Lightning Network for several years now, which is a high speed, you know, state channel network for mostly for small and fast payments. But you're seeing several teams that are planning to launch rollups on Bitcoin, including one. I interviewed the founder of one today on the podcast of mine, Galaxy Brains, that came out this morning. Orkin Kilich, who's the CEO of Chainway Labs, which builds Citria, which is a ZK rollup for Bitcoin that's going to launch in the next month or two, he says. There's obviously renewed enthusiasm around developing Bitcoin and Bitcoin adjacent stuff, which I would say is primarily deriving from the invention, creation, discovery of inscriptions and ordinals on Bitcoin, which themselves are doing a big volume. I think I saw NFT marketplaces in total volumes and NFTs are still down huge from 2021. Huge. I mean, not close. But Bitcoin carried NFTs, which are, you know, effectively ordinals, all of them, I believe, doing huge portions of the volume on these platforms that offer them. So that's an interesting area, L2s. Obviously, modularity and restaking in the Ethereum world and in the broader L1 world is very powerful. And then parallelization in all L1. So like Solana, obviously, lots of usage on Solana. Really not, I think, quite clearly in terms of adoption and usage, the third most widely used chain. And I like that because it's meaningfully differentiated from a technology standpoint. It's not an EVM clone. Right. Yeah. So I think that's quite interesting. But again, DeFi, Web3, metaverse, gaming, I'm really just not hearing a lot about this right now. It doesn't seem like that's where the market is. I know that on several of these, they're either already very important or there's good prospects. But this really does seem more of like a Bitcoin L1 and L2, an ETF L1, L2 story, an ETH, like basically staking ETH or restaking it, and modularity in L2 story, and then that, and then meme coins primarily. Like that's what I see the narratives happening now. We'll see where it goes, but obviously, truly, still the biggest story is just the outsized inflows into the Bitcoin ETFs, which really have surprised everyone.
Yeah, and you know, one of your incredible recent reports that came out. I love the title. It's called "Why We Aren't Popping." And then in parentheses before the word top, it was S. So why we aren't stopping. I like, it's a little play on words there.
Top won't top. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think it's awesome. And you covered a ton. I mean, on-chain metrics, ETF flows. I was just wondering if we could get your synopsis or your bite size sort of what things you thought, kind of what you found most interesting in that large report that you put out at Galaxy.
Yeah, I think the thing that people had been raising, this is last week, it's basically the morning we hit the all-time high of 69,325, I think is what Coinbase now has it as. So that is the new all-time high in Bitcoin. And we're not quite there again yet. You know, obviously that was that ended up being an extremely volatile day. I think Bitcoin had it, I don't know if it was his first, I think it was, it might not have been his first. There was some volatility in April and May of 2021 that was pretty extreme, but that was a $10,000 candle of a day, right? We went from 69,
up and down.
Yeah, 3225 down to 59,200 something I saw before pairing those losses and coming back into the mid 60s. So yeah, it was a very volatile day. One of the things that people had been asking me was, you know, isn't it weird that we're like running it to all-time high before the halving? I thought the whole story was that the halving tended to precede the start.
Historically, it has.
It has historically. And I put out some numbers in that one, and I don't have them right in front of me, but the gist was pretty straightforward. At that point, when I wrote that note, it was 52 days out from April 20th, which is, you know, the expected halving date. It's sometime around there, 18th or 21st or obviously, it depends on hash rate and difficulty and stuff like that. But let's call it April 20th. That's what I used for the number. And I said 52. And then, of course, we know the dates of the prior halving. So I looked back 52 days prior to the other halvings. And basically, Bitcoin was off like 50 or 60% still from its all-time high. Yeah. But when I wrote that morning, we were, you know, only 12% off the all-time high. And of course, we then later hit it the next week. So, is that concerning, right? Some people have said, wait a sec, what if we're, I've literally seen this on Twitter from big accounts too. We might be speed running this cycle.
Are freaking out.
Right. And to me, and that's what I meant when I said, I'm sorry. I know that's something to look at. I know we all have battle scars and we're jaded and we went through a lot and we have PTSD from these markets, but I'm here to tell you that this time is different. First of all, the data is different, which I've just shown you. Yes, it is different. Mm-hmm. But again, this is driven by, especially year to date, like this is driven by massive capital inflows. So it is, and those are big stories. So they're narrative events, but narrative events that are flows stories are real catalysts. They bring capital in. They take coins off. The journal, Wall Street Journal this morning wrote a story. And it said, hold on, let me just pull it up. Their story this morning was Bitcoin bulls cite simple reason for rally, not enough coins. I'm telling you, like, first of all, this is the Wall Street Journal. I love it. They're educating the readership of the journal in
supply
Bitcoin
and demand.
Yeah, because that's what I mean. So like it is different because we didn't have giant piles of capital. I think there's $48 trillion in AUM in the US that is at advisor or wealth management platforms that hasn't had access to Bitcoin exposure, right? Sure. I mean, this is like the advisors that are either independent or they're the advisors that are affiliated with banks and broker dealers, you know, like Merrill and Morgan Stanley and whatnot and all these other ones. So that's a huge pile of assets. And we did a report in October that said that if only 10% of that, in fact, it was even less. We held it flat. We said 10% of that AUM chooses to do 1%, but not even the whole sector in year one. Then we ramped up over years 1, 2, 3, what portion of the total would do it. And we were pretty conservative. So we said like 25% of the BDs would turn it on. And then if 10% of the AUM there allocated 1% to Bitcoin, and we did this, but we said $14.5 billion in net inflows in year one. And we're at like 12 or 10 like now or something. I don't know more. I haven't even checked at this point in terms of flows. It's crazy. Yeah, and that's before those platforms come. Like those platforms have not turned on yet. So you've seen some independent RIAs, but not the actual bank and broker dealer platforms. So though this time is different because you have these giant new market access vehicles vacuuming up coins very often 10 times the daily production of Bitcoin per day, right?
Yeah.
Like 10,000 coins were net inflowed 2 days ago. Bitcoin produces about 900 coins per day. So like it's that is effectively a massive new wave of demand slamming up against an immutable supply, right? And that in this there it Bitcoin supply is completely inelastic, right? Even with gold, which is thought of and is a scarce asset, if all of a sudden you had billions of dollars trying to buy tons of gold, the gold producers would mine more.
There is more.
They just, you know, they're weighing the supply and demand. Well, it doesn't matter how much demand for Bitcoin is. Nobody can mine more. So that is playing out. And so that makes this time different, right? For sure. And then in the rest of that piece, I mean, I did some things. I looked at like some various metrics where, you know, some metrics that I like, I don't rely too hard on various like on-chain data or really any metrics that I really swear by, but some that I like. MVRV is a pretty simple one. It's market value to realized value. So it's like taking the market cap of Bitcoin, which we all know, last price times coin supply, which, you know, today is 1.3 trillion or something like that. And then you do the realized cap, which is basically instead of valuing every coin in existence at today's price, the price that we multiply the coins by is at the price they last moved on chain. So if I buy a coin for $100 and then that is that coin's contribution to the total cap is only $100, right? It's not today's, right? So what it does is it helps you estimate the estimated cost basis of the network, right? Because we say, look, I mean, we don't want to, sure, Bryce bought a coin, you know, Alex bought a coin in 2011. Good for him, right? Did I? No, I wish I had, but did I, right? But that we're not going to gross up the value of that coin to $67,000. He didn't pay that, right? And so then when you look at the ratio between, so we do that for all the coins, whenever they moved in Summit, that's called realized cap. It's available on many of the data provider sites. So, but then the ratio of the two can give you a sense. Historically, this is the MVRV ratio, right? And then you can turn it into a Z-score, which helps you make it look like an oscillator rather than two lines, but whatever, it's the same idea. It can give you an idea of the level at which, how overheated or not the market is, basically. And when you look at past peaks and troughs, you can see it be pretty nicely effective. And I was just pointing out that, like, it's not really that close to, like, anything that we have to, you know, worry about as a top, which was the whole point of the paper, and some other things, too. But really at the thrust is just that, like, there is a giant new wave of demand smashing against a totally immutable supply. And, like, that's what happens, folks.
I love it. Summarized it perfectly. And I know that you had a poli-sci background. You were working in the legal department. I want to get your take, any hot takes on regulatory sort of outlook for crypto. I'll start with saying that I thought it was really bullish. I'm kind of reading into the tea leaves, but the market definitely priced it very positively when Uniswap announced that they were proposing to turn on the fees. Flip on the fee switch for holders and stakers of the Uniswap token. It's something that they kind of had in their back pocket for a long time. And I think that somewhere along the way, they got some kind of signal, maybe not an explicit signal, but something's changing that now this is an appropriate legal maneuver. What do you make of that? And plus just any other things that you kind of ruminate on?
Yeah, I've heard that theory. I can't substantiate it at all. I don't know if anything about what the specific motivation was to do the fee switch. Now I know that the fee switch has been proposed multiple times and not for years. And at this time it was proposed by the governance lead at the Uniswap Foundation. So it does seem significant. Obviously, it would be significant for Uniswap. It's a big deal. I don't know about that one specifically, but I will say, I mean, the things that I think are most at the forefront of discussion on Capitol Hill today, when we talk about Capitol Hill, is anti-money laundering and illicit finance stuff. So particularly Senator Warren's Digital Asset Anti-Money Laundering Act, which I've been a very loud and consistent vocal critic of, because I believe it would effectively criminalize operating open source software that powers these networks in the United States. So the bill, the senator claims that and argues that shouldn't crypto firms have to follow the same rules as banks? Well, first of all, like, that's a tricky conversation because most financial firms don't follow the same rules as banks. Like, banks have a very specific set of rules, but leaving that aside, crypto firms do the bank like AML KYC stuff that she's referring to. Like, Galaxy does AML KYC, Coinbase does AML KYC. Her bill doesn't target crypto firms. Her bill targets open source software. It targets nodes, validators, developers of open source wallet software. First of all, it's totally unenforceable. Second of all, even if it was, it would effectively outlaw the operation of software in the United States. It's crazy in my mind.
Ridiculous. Terrible.
But there's a lot of discussion about this because there's, you know, because of geopolitical events, because of whatnot, like there is a desire to get something done to help government do a better job at its job, which of course does include interdicting illicit funds moving either from our enemies to the other enemies or to terrorists and stuff. So like, it's understandable that this is something government is concerned with. But of course, that is at top of mind. And now you obviously have, particularly driven by House Financial Services Committee Chairman Patrick McHenry, interest in doing something on stablecoins and maybe comprehensive market, market structure bill. So stablecoins, pretty straightforward. Like, I think there's a significant demand in the market and from a variety of players, not just from crypto, but even from financial services companies and in some cases from the Fed, right, to do something to legalize and formalize how stablecoins actually work in the United States. We've been close before. I don't know if anything will happen on it, but I think most people are supportive that, well, I mean, something should happen. In my mind, stablecoins, I mean, aren't nearly as interesting to me as, say, Bitcoin is at all. But yeah. On the other hand, I mean, they're definitely useful. Public blockchains are significantly better than traditional. And I've seen some people push back. Well, what about Zelle or what about FedNow or Brazil has a new real-time payment system? Sure, those are great, but that's not really like the same thing. They're closed. They're not global. And by the way, have those too. We're just saying like there's $142 billion in fiat-backed stablecoins that like obviously there's demand for this product. You're not like, well, we have Fed now, so we no longer need ACH. Like, no, dude, they can all live. Like the dollar, you know, the global currencies need to be everywhere. Like I tell people about Bitcoin when they can get concerned. Well, is it really good if it's all in the ETF? Are you supposed to be self-custody? Absolutely, you should self-custody if you know how. But if you believe that Bitcoin is going to be widely adopted as money, well, it needs to be in your bank account, in your brokerage account, in your personal wallet, under your bed, in your cold card, and your treasury. Sir. Like money exists in many forms. So like stablecoins are absolutely and should be part of that discussion when it comes to like the US dollar, because it's obviously proven technology. There's tons of demand for it. So I hope stablecoins can happen. Market structure is tricky. I'd be shocked if anything really happens, but that's all about whether or not to have the SEC or the CFTC regulate different parts of this. We're not, I don't think we're going to see much there. From the regulatory standpoint, you still have a fair number of tricky things looming. I mean, you've got this exchange definition proposal from the SEC, which explicitly draws in large swaths of DeFi. You've got the IRS broker rule, which they've been proposing. They've now put forth the rule, but we need guidance on the rule. So I think they're technically delaying the implementation until there's some more further guidance. But it also explicitly states things like, you know, if a DAO has upgraded the protocol in the past, then that we view that as evidence that it could be upgraded to comply with this thing. Right. So like these aren't accidentally bringing in parts of crypto, primarily DeFi, which is what is really targeted in my mind by most of these looming things. It's not accidental. It's explicit. The SEC wrote about 70 pages in their comment reopener for the exchange definition all about how it does apply to DeFi. Right. This is not an instance of a lack of clarity. This is an instance of, well, I think the clarity is bad, but like they're being very explicit with the clarity, right? So there are some looming issues there in the US, obviously, but, you know, just broadly, like, and even though the SEC chairman in his note that he sent when he voted to approve the Bitcoin ETFs, he denied this. I think the market is seeing the Bitcoin ETF approvals as, you know, some form of a stamp of approval on the asset, or at least on the process. And of course, the SEC doesn't do that. They don't. But, you know, it kind of looks like that. I had Commissioner Hester Peirce on Galaxy Brands, and she made the point that, like, you know, it is kind of being viewed like that, like a stamp of approval, particularly because they did deny them for 10 years. If they just treated it like normal, then it wouldn't be this huge thing that the SEC approved it. But by denying it, having to get sued and lose in court and then finally approving, it kind of like elevated the importance of the approval to the point where now it really matters to the market. So there's a variety of things. I think, you know, the U.S. is in a privileged position with most of the capital that has been deployed in venture in the crypto space. Probably most of the Bitcoins are in the U.S. I don't know. It's hard to know that. But
yeah,
tons of developer mindshare in the U.S. And we always hear about how some is leaving and some is leaving. I write about venture and I've shown that there are people, the foreign off the ex-U.S. share of capital raise and deal count is rising, but the U.S. still leads here. I just hope they don't fumble. You know, we don't fumble the ball.
Yeah. Oh, man. That was incredible. And I wish that we could speak for 3 more hours. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I have one last question. I'm hoping folks who are listening could get a good tip on some free to use resources that maybe you or your team use in order to, like, you know, scrape good data. Like, what are some of the best places to find kind of like free data? Because we all can't afford a team of analysts to put freshly printed papers of research on our desk, unfortunately.
Yeah. I will say a couple paid data vendor. I mean, so we also don't create all of our own data. We do buy data from, and there are, at this point, that's another part of maturity in this market. There are plenty of high quality data providers. I've worked with Coinmetrics and Amber Data for years. Coinmetrics is a fair amount of free data. You know, if you just go to charts.coinmetrics.io, you can get plenty. Amber, Dune, Glassnode, I use all of these on a repeated basis. Dune is free as well. You have to, you know, there's free dashboards, but you can actually code your own queries there. Okay, so some a little bit more obscure free things that I like. Velo Data is a new derivatives data provider. It's free. It's pretty good. It's not as comprehensive as the expensive ones, but it's good. It works. It gives you a good snapshot of the market. Look into Bitcoin. I think they now have a paid one. I think it's lookintobitcoin.com. They have tons of things like MVRV that I was talking about, these sort of on-chain Bitcoin metrics, tons of those. Obviously the DeFi Llamas and the Crypto Slams and all these various websites, CoinGecko, obviously a huge resource for everyone. There's a lot. There's actually quite a lot of free data. It really depends on, in fact, most of these data providers will provide at least some, if not a lot, of data for free. And what you end up paying for is like API access or data downloads or something like that. Or so those are just a few I threw out there, Bryce, that I've used certainly over the years.
Awesome. Yeah, I've used all of those as well, except Crypto Slam. I actually just Googled that one. I'm going to check that one out.
I think we mostly look at it when we do look at it for NFT related information.
Got it. All right. Well, hey, Alex, really appreciate you spending the hour with us today. Where can we direct all of our good citizens of Crypt Nation to follow along on Twitter? Do you guys do Telegram groups, or, you know, just send them to the website?
Yeah, I mean, you can read all of our public content at galaxy.com/research. Listen to my podcast, Galaxy Brains. It's on all the platforms. Also, my colleague, Christine Kim, has a great podcast about Ethereum called Infinite Jungle, which is also on all the places. And follow me at Intangible Coins on Twitter or at GLXY Research, GLXY Research on Twitter. That's our team's handle.
Love it. Amazing, perfect, beautiful. A tour de force, Alex Thorne, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you enjoyed. And Alex, thank you and hope you enjoyed as well.
Yeah, thank you, Bryce. Great to be here.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit 2, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.